Hi, welcome to Lab Medicine's podcast series. I'm Kelly Swales. I'm the web editor of Lab Medicine magazine, and today I have with me Dr. David Webb from the University of Virginia. He's going to speak a little bit about malaria identification.
Hello, and thank you, Kelly. First, I want to thank ASCP for this opportunity to give this talk and for the numerous opportunities that they've provided to me as a laboratory professional and as a physician over the past decade. So, specifically during this podcast, I will briefly introduce malaria to those in the audience that are unfamiliar with this worldwide disease, and then I'll quickly move into a morphologic-based approach to identifying and speciating these parasites. The historical aspect of malaria is very interesting, however, will not be the focus of this talk, nor will I speak of the treatment or the numerous governmental efforts that are currently in place to control malaria. So starting from the very basics, we should all know that malaria is a serious and sometimes fatal disease caused by a parasite that commonly infects a certain type of mosquito, which then feeds on humans. Those infected can present quickly with typical flu-like symptoms, including chills and high fevers, that subsequently pass and cyclically repeat again hours later. If not treated promptly, it can lead to death. However, we know death is preventable through proper identification and timely treatment. Malaria occurs in tropical and subtropical areas, and in over 100 countries and territories, and more than a third of the world's population is at risk. Malaria was eliminated from the U.S. by the early 1950s, but still about 1,500 cases of malaria are diagnosed in the U.S. each year. Most of these cases occur in travelers and immigrants returning from those endemic areas. The World Health Organization estimates that more than 1 million people every year die from malaria, especially those from sub-Saharan Africa, most deaths occurring in young children. So the diagnosis of malaria can be difficult. To properly detect and speciate malaria, laboratory professionals need a foundation of knowledge, not only in microbiology, but also in microscopic morphology. Reliable identification of organisms requires continuous training to maintain expertise. Therefore, those labs that rarely see positive specimens should employ proficiency testing in these areas, or alternatively, may choose to refer specimens to reference labs. More advanced laboratory methods, including acridine orange staining and detection of parasite-specific DNA, show promising sensitivity and specificity, but may not be readily available in smaller laboratories. Additionally, immunocapture assays, which detect plasmodium-specific lactate dehydrogenase, show promising results. Now let's talk about the peripheral blood smear. Identification of malarial parasites on thin blood films is still recognized as the gold standard and should be offered as a stat test, underscoring the importance of being comfortable with the morphologic features of these parasites. Specimens should be collected before or at the onset of fever, and the slides should be made within 2 hours of collection. This is because when left at room temperature, the malarial parasite will form unusual structures, making proper speciation more difficult. When infected, the first set of smears will usually be positive. A total of 3 smears, taken at 3-hour intervals, are needed to exclude malaria. Identification requires a systemic approach. 2 smears are essential for diagnosis. A thin smear, which is most helpful for species identification and can be read quickly, and a thick smear, which requires a longer drying time, but is much more specific. Once malaria has been identified, it's then important to attempt to speciate the parasite. There are 5 main types of malaria known to infect humans: Plasmodium falciparum, Vivax, Ovale, malariae, and the most recently discovered Nolesi. For many years, we only distinguish between falciparum and non-falciparum species. This is because P. falciparum is known for its rapidly aggressive and sometimes fatal clinical course. However, we now know that P. nolesi can have an aggressive clinical course and therefore also needs to be positively identified to initiate appropriate care. A second reason for speciation is to identify P. ovale and P. vivax, which are known to have a latent liver stage, and therefore patients can present with late recurrences unless treated properly. Before diving into speciation, let's first touch briefly on the life cycle of Plasmodium. Please refer to photo number 1. When an infected female Anopheles mosquito bites a human, she injects 5 to 10 sporozoites into the bloodstream. Within minutes, those sporozoites then travel to the liver and develop into schizonts. Within a week or so, mature schizonts rupture, spilling 10,000 to 40,000 merozoites in the bloodstream. The merozoites then infect the circulating red blood cell population and develop into gametocytes, which are the sexual stage, and trophozoites, the asexual stage. Gametocytes can then be ingested by other mosquitoes, perpetuating the life cycle, while trophozoites develop into schizonts, which rupture and release more merozoites. It is this biphasic split in the life cycle that has made eradicating malaria most difficult. Now, let's begin with speciation. P. falciparum has a wide geographic distribution and is the most common cause of malarial deaths. P. falciparum has the ability to achieve very high levels of parasitemia and can therefore cause severe end organ damage, which leads to death, especially in the very old and the very young. One of the first clues for identifying P. falciparum is when more than the occasional red blood cell has been infected. P. falciparum has known to infect nearly half of the circulating red blood cell mass, and when observed, speciation can be quick and reliable. If you'll refer to photo number 2, you'll see the diagnostic clues that you're dealing with P. falciparum. It has a tendency to infect normal-sized red blood cells, and you can also see more than one parasite in the same red cell. Most likely, P. falciparum will be seen in its delicate ring trophozoite form, in which it takes up a very small percentage of the infected red cell. Occasionally, as seen in photo 3, you may see the pathognomic banana-shaped gametocytes, and when you do, you can be confident that your patient is infected by P. falciparum. However, these gametocytes are not always present for our viewing pleasure. So let's summarize the important points of P. falciparum. We know that it's the most common cause of malarial-related death, that it has the ability to infect a large red blood cell mass, and that those red cells are usually of normal size. Remember that you can see multiple parasites in a single red cell, and these parasites are small and delicate, trophozoites, and can take up a small area within the red cell. And don't forget the pathognomic banana-shaped gametocyte. So now let's move to P. vivax. Unlike P. falciparum, P. vivax is not typically encountered in fulminant malaria. However, P. vivax is known to cause its own set of problems. Most notably, it is known to remain dormant in the liver for a prolonged period of time and emerge even years later. Again, another reason that speciation is so important, to initiate proper treatment to eradicate not only the circulating parasites, but those also remaining dormant in the hepatic parenchyma. In comparison to P. falciparum, P. vivax causes lower levels of parasitemia. If you refer to photo number 4, you will notice other differences, in that P. vivax preferentially infects younger, larger erythrocytes, and that typically only a single parasite is seen per infected red blood cell. Growing trophozoites of P. vivax have irregular shapes and are termed amoeboid, as seen in photo number 5. Do notice that the amoeboid trophozoite takes up a large percentage of the infected red blood cell. The ring forms of P. vivax tend to be similar, but less delicate than the ring forms of P. falciparum. In photo number 6, you will also notice coarse stippling of the cytoplasm of the infected cells. This is known as Schuffner stippling, and is commonly seen in P. vivax infected cells. However, be aware that Schuffner stippling can also be seen in P. ovale infected red blood cells. If you'll refer to photo number 7, you will see another form encountered in P. vivax. This is the gametocytic form, which is commonly encountered and appears rounded in comparison to the elongated form seen in P. falciparum. Photo number 8 contains another stage of P. vivax, the schizon, which contains, on average, 16 individual merozoites. To summarize P. vivax, you should now know that it's a non-fulminant malaria that infects enlarged erythrocytes, has a latent liver stage, shows Schuffner stippling, has a rounded gametocyte form, and can show a fairly specific amoeboid trophozoite form. Now let's talk about P. ovale. Of all the species of malaria affecting humans, it is difficult to distinguish between P. vivax and P. ovale. This may in fact be inconsequential, as their clinical courses are similar, and therefore each are treated the same. Clinically, P. ovale and P. vivax share the same latent liver stage, and neither cause fulminant disease due to their low levels of parasitemia. Morphologically, they're quite similar. They both tend to infect those large, young red cells. Schuffner stippling is present, and both the gametocyte and schizon forms are commonly encountered. One of the distinguishing features between P. ovale and P. vivax is the trophozoite form. If you refer to photo number 9, you'll see that in P. ovale infected red blood cells, the trophozoite form is compact and condensed and tends not to take up a large area. A second, and less easily identified characteristic of P. ovale infected cells, is a tendency for them to develop a border with irregular projections, which is also called fimbriated, as seen in photo number 10. The gametocyte form of P. ovale tends to be somewhat more elongate than P. vivax. To summarize P. ovale, it has a latent liver stage, infects enlarged erythrocytes, can show Schuffner stippling, and to help differentiate it from P. vivax, can show a fimbriated form. Moving onward, let's now talk about P. malariae and P. nolesi. Because they are morphologically similar, we'll talk about these two species in tandem. P. malariae is similar to P. ovale and P. vivax in that it is a non-fulminant malaria, but dissimilar in that it lacks a dormant liver stage. In recent years, the primate form, P. nolesi parasite, has shown the ability to infect humans. Although morphologically similar to P. malariae, it clinically mimics the aggressiveness of P. falciparum, again, highlighting the importance of speciation. Similar to P. ovale and P. vivax, P. nolesi and P. malariae have low levels of parasitemia, however dissimilarly are identified in normal-sized red blood cells. The trophozoites can show a fairly specific band form, shown in photo number 11. Schuffner's stippling is not typically present. Early ring-form trophozoites of P. nolesi are similar to P. falciparum and may also show double chromatin dots, as seen in photo number 12. One of the better ways to differentiate P. malariae and P. nolesi is that P. nolesi has a 24-hour cycle and P. malariae has a 72-hour cycle. To summarize P. malariae and P. nolesi, they both show similar morphology, but P. nolesi can be a bad actor. They both parasitize normal-sized red blood cells, are without Schuffner stippling, and can show a fairly specific band form. Let's briefly now talk about a few common pitfalls. Multiple artifacts can be seen when looking at both thick and thin films. Most commonly, platelets overlying a red blood cell should not be confused with a ring form. Be aware also that bacteria can look similar to a Schizont form. Precipitated stains should also not lead to a misdiagnosis. To finalize, we all know that malaria is a serious parasitic disease that affects millions of people worldwide. We as laboratory professionals are at the front lines of the diagnosis and subsequent treatment of those affected, and therefore we owe it to ourselves, our patients, our communities, and the world at large to be proficient in not only diagnosing, but furthermore, accurate speciation to aid in the worldwide control and future eradication of this deadly parasite. The CDC website contains a plethora of well-organized information that can aid the bench technologist in speciation. Henry's Clinical Diagnosis and Lab Management text also contains a very good synopsis for your reading pleasure. Thank you, ASCP, and thank you, Kelly, for this opportunity.
Thanks, Dr. Webb. I know I worked in microbiology for several years, and I know that malarial identifications could be a little bit tricky, and I think you gave our listeners a lot of great information.
Great. Thank you.